Americans to wake up. Is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest podcast from peterbcollins.com. This program is supported by subscribers, great people like Albert Valencia, Mark Brodsky, Julia Fung, and Trudy Wally. You can do it too. Just sign up at peterbcollins.com. The month of April, our goal is to double our subscriber list. So tell a friend and let them know we have an inducement. No Ginsu knives, but we've got a free signed book, Hank Albarelli's book about the CIA's secret programs that included LSD back in the 50s and 60s. It's called A Terrible Mistake. And you can find out the details on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. Remember Bush and Cheney? We haven't heard much from Bush. Cheney's got a heart, or a new heart, maybe his first one, and it appears that some of the very careful cover-ups that were successful while Bush and Cheney were in office that have remained largely unchallenged under the Obama administration, that those cover-ups are starting to unravel. Jason Leopold returns to our program. He was with us just a week or two ago, but he has broken another powerful story at truthout.org that pulls back the curtain on some of the torture practices, the origin of torture memos, and other issues related to the so-called war on terror and the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that occurred after 9/11. Jason, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be back with you, Peter. Thanks.
And I want to credit your co-author who helped report on this piece and who's also been a stalwart in taking on the torture machinery, Jeffrey Kay, who is a psychologist and moonlights as a reporter for truthout.org. And he has held a standard to the American Psychological Association. He has written very effectively and credibly about the issues of torture and the legacy of that. And I really commend you guys because we know the corporate media has moved on.
Yeah.
They're not so interested in what happened and who got hurt. And I believe that it's very important for us to expose, understand, and to the extent we can, hold people accountable. And in our immediately preceding podcast, I was talking with former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman about her new book, Cheating Justice, which does a great job of defining the briefs against Bush, Cheney, and their comrades for significant and very serious law-breaking while they were in office. And while Holtzman doesn't apply the same standard to Obama, I do give her credit for her focus on the Bush administration.
Yeah, that's, you know, it is very important. You know, thanks for mentioning Jeff. And, you know, Jeff and I feel that very strongly that we make a very good team. He and I have reported together extensively on these issues over the past 2.5 years, and you know what we share is a passion for truly, you know, reporting the truth, getting the you know, documenting this and trying to explain to the public why it matters, why it's important, why they need to pay attention, despite the fact that, you know, there may be a Democrat in the White House or. You know, this has nothing to do with partisanship. So, the fact that Jeff being the co-author on this, it's this truly was and is a team effort, and we have a number of other stories set for down the road.
Well, Jason, first of all, describe for our listeners this memo that has a bland, if not innocuous, title.
Right.
Pre-academic laboratory operating instructions.
Yes.
What the hell does that mean?
It's a very bland title, and it's let me give you just a brief little backstory regarding it. This is a manual that was cited in the office, Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility report that was issued a couple of years ago pertaining to the legal work that John Yoo, Jay Bybee, and Stephen Bradbury, all of the Office of Legal Counsel, Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, the work that they did in writing the what is widely referred to as the torture memo, in this case, torture memos. In that report, buried in that report, actually, is a citation that was taken directly from this manual, this instructional manual, that was presented in the context of the difference between, the real-world interrogations versus what's in this manual are enormous. There's a an enormous difference is that one is real and one is a one is a mock prisoner of war setting.
Mm-hmm.
So this manual is actually what is known as a training manual for the survival, evasion, resistance, escape. What U.S. personnel go through in order to learn how to survive brutal interrogations, torture, if they are captured by an enemy regime.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes this important is two things. One, this is, as I indicated, it was cited in that Office of Professional Responsibility report. It's important because it's dated, at least according to the OPR report, May 7th, 2002. We know, I've confirmed with a number of sources, but we know it was shared with top White House officials, and there actually have been a number of stories that came out back in 2009 when the torture memos were released about these so-called Principals Committee meetings,
right,
where Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and legal advisor to Condoleezza Rice, where they all discussed, and John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez, where they all discussed the CIA's interest, in using quote unquote an alternative set of interrogation methods. And these discussions took place in between May and July of 2002, before mm-hmm. that memo was written.
And one of the critical timeline points that you disclose
yeah.
is that the torture practices preceded the paperwork that authorized them.
That's right. It is. That's very important. And in fact, with this manual, what it shows, again, this is a manual that was used to when U.S. service members, when U.S. military personnel are going through survival training, okay, and they are subjected to the types of techniques to it would help them survive in that sort of mock prisoner of war setting. This is what it, what this manual basically is. And so this manual then was shared with the Principals Committee in May of 2002.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a very important piece, very important document in understanding the origin of the Bush torture program.
Well, it's a blueprint for the torture practices, and John Yoo was present when these methods were discussed, and then he was dispatched to write a memo to change the definition of torture and to change the context so that these practices could be used, and Bush, with an alleged straight face, could say, oh, we don't torture.
Correct. That's exactly it. And for me, this certainly changed my understanding certainly of the timeline as to how this evolved.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really important to note here, Peter, is that 7 out of the 10 techniques that ended up in John Yoo's torture memo are lifted, you know, right out of this, are contained in this memo. I mean, in this, in this manual.
Right.
7 out of the 10. We do know that there have been other SEER documents that the administration used to craft their, you know, to craft that torture memo and to basically, come up with some techniques. What makes this unique? What makes this so important? And I haven't been able to find any evidence to contradict this. This is actually the first training manual, the first full document that we can see that the Bush administration used as they prepared that memo. And what makes that important is that this manual describes in great detail what these techniques are and what the purpose of these techniques are.
The desired effect of each method is.
That's exactly right. That's one of the most important parts of this, in terms of really understanding it and why people really need to, take the time to look at it. This is it's sort of an almost like an exploitation manual as well. Excuse me. And as Colonel Steve Kleinman says, who is quoted in our story, he's a veteran intelligence officer and an interrogator, SEER instructor. I mean, this is an individual with impeccable credentials. He took a look at this when I had sent it to him, and immediately he said he knew what this was. This is the guidebook. These are his words, the guidebook to getting false confessions. That's what this is. That is what this administration used. This is how they were able to obtain false confessions related to Iraq and Al-Qaeda, the link there. There's a new book out called The Hunt for KSM, referring to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in which the authors Josh Meyer and Terry McDermott talk about the torture that KSM was subjected to and how that resulted in false confession. So that was almost a desired, or at least to me it seems, a desired effect of this.
And I'll note that on the day we're speaking here, the 4th of April, the Obama administration has announced that the kangaroo court trial at Guantanamo, the military commission for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, will be going forward in this election year. I think that's very interesting political timing on their part.
Yes, it is. I mean, look, I'm not surprised. I'm actually a little surprised they didn't announce that the trial would take place in October, a month before the election.
Right.
But, this is to really understand how this torture program evolved, what it meant, what it was all about. This document becomes, another important piece of the puzzle. May of 2002, Peter, which is what is the date that's on the document. Now, I want to make it clear that I'm not sure if that date is actually the date they accessed it, the day it was prepared,
right,
or the date it was filed. However, if we go with the OPR report, May 7th, 2002.
We know it existed on that date. It may have been prepared beforehand.
Correct. And we know it was shared in principals committee meetings that took place that month. The Senate Intelligence Committee has already released documents which are basically a timeline leading up to the torture memo. They released this after Obama released those memos back in 2009, and the Senate Intelligence Committee put together a timeline and showing what the genesis was leading, the discussions that took place, rather, that, led up to the drafting of the memo. So May of 2002 is a very important time frame certainly in the evolution of Abu Zubaydah's interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first high-value detainee captured after 9/11.
And he was the one essentially subjected to human experiments That's what you and Jeff Kay have written about previously.
Exactly. That's how they were able to, you know, come up with a certain number of days for sleep deprivation by subjecting him to it, or the amount of water to be used in waterboarding. So May of 2002 is really when these techniques started to be is when James Mitchell, the CIA contractor, started to introduce these techniques at the black site in Thailand, the CIA black site prison where he was held. May of 2002 is when Ali Soufan, former FBI special agent, who first interrogated Zubaydah at the black site, he said the last straw for him was when James Mitchell introduced a confinement box. That's what he called it. He called it a confinement box in May of 2002, and he left. He left the black site prison. He called up headquarters, spoke to his boss, and said, the boss said, come on back. In this manual, Peter, okay, again, really want to emphasize that May 2002 date, one of the techniques is cramped confinement.
Yeah.
Okay? And Ali Soufan had a partner who was out there with him. His name is Steve Godin. And Steve Godin decided to stay behind. And according to the FBI's Inspector General report, which took a look at Zubaydah's torture and the role that the FBI played, Steve Godin said that he decided not to leave, okay, the black site, because he didn't have any moral objections to what was taking place, because he had gone through that during his Army SEER training. So the point I'm making here is that, you know, this is the puzzle piece. You start putting together the puzzle, you know, and it's clear then that that authorization, and perhaps it was verbal authorization, but there was no memo written. You know, they were the CIA was claiming that Zubaydah, you know, possessed imminent threat information.
Right.
He was withholding, and we needed him to, you know, to give up that information.
The ticking time bomb,
right?
Just
so that
like
verbal
24.
Authorization, you know, went out, and these techniques, the techniques that are in this training manual, is what they started to use. And you know, one thing about this manual that Colonel Steve Kleiman emphasized, Brent Mickham, who's the Zubaydah's attorney, emphasized, they both took a look at this, and they came up with the same response, more or less, was when we subjected our own service members to these techniques, we emphasized safety. Safety was so important. We wanted to make sure they didn't fall into what's known as, you know, a state of learned helplessness. And I have a definition of in the story of, you know, of what learned helplessness is. So, for example, that cramped confinement box that U.S. service members were placed into, it could go. They could not be placed in there longer than 20 minutes. Okay, it was for their safety. In the torture memo, the cramped confinement box is a technique, and it says that the detainee can't be placed in there longer than 18 hours.
Wow.
Depending on the size of the box. So between 2 and 18 hours. I think 2 hours for a smaller box and 18 hours for a larger one. So when you hear, or when we have heard, former officials like Condoleezza Rice saying, I was assured of about the safety of these techniques because our own service members have gone through it, well, that's wrong. They haven't. They had not gone through, you know, training that required them to sit for 18 hours in a box.
Well, and one thing we know is that even in a simulated situation where you're taking somebody through a torture technique, that it's being done by people who are your friends, or at least they're friendly, and your safety is important, and they won't push the limits. But in the atmosphere of the phony notion of a ticking time bomb, and
right.
You know, anything goes as long as you don't quite kill him or cause organ failure, as John Yu wrote in his memo.
Right.
Then that is a very, very different context. from the carefully controlled climates where this original handbook or manual was being used.
That's right. And, you know, Steve, again, Steve Kleinman makes that point. The detainees had no idea whether they were being subjected to these techniques and it would result in death. They had no idea if their interrogators wanted to kill them. They didn't know that this was, you know, that they were being subjected to something that was training. This is, you know, they thought that they were going to be killed. And as he notes, Steve Kleinman, he says, look, you know, in a training environment, as soon as you raise your hand, it's over. That doesn't happen. That didn't happen here.
Yeah.
So.
But let me flip that for a moment, Jason, sure. And just pose this question. Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded how many times?
As far as we know, it's 83 times.
Okay, let's just use that number. Somewhere along the way, he figured out that they were not going to take him so far that it would kill him. It may have been the second time, it may have been the 40th time. But that's one of the phony notions about repeated applications of these techniques that scare the shit out of people because they think they're going to die.
Right.
When you stop before they die, in one of these repetitions, they figure out that they can survive it.
Right.
And it just, once again, produces false confessions. It produces the desire to tell them anything to get this to stop. But it doesn't produce that pure threat of death that theoretically the hardliners like Dick Cheney think will produce intelligence product.
Right, exactly. This brings us to the the sort of next important point here is that, again, what Kleinman says is that if your goal is to get reliable intelligence, reliable information, this is not the guidebook to use. This is not the guidebook to use. Why? Because this is the guidebook to use if you want to get false confession. And we spoke about this last year, Peter, when Jeff and I wrote another exclusive story, which this actually makes a very nice companion piece to that, regarding the handwritten notes that we obtained from were drafted by Bruce Jessen, mm-hmm. who's a psychologist. He is the one who was at the black site later on. He was a partner with James Mitchell, and both have been credited as being the architects of this program. So in those notes that he prepared, which at this point is almost 2 decades ago, you know, talked about if you were being subjected to these types of techniques, the purpose is exploitation, propaganda. Again, those are actually in this manual, talks about various forms of exploitation, media, political. I mean, they actually talked about, having a press conference where they would march the detainees out before reporters. Yeah. They would be hooded, and reporters would ask questions. I mean, this sort of doesn't that give you sort of the image of a true sort of communist regime? And we have no evidence that's actually, what took place with regard to the detainees we had in our custody. We certainly do know that there have been government officials who acted in the role of the different, they took on different roles. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it wasn't a reporter, but it was something else. Again, it's that type of propaganda.
Well, and Jason, the passages about a mock news conference really rang a bell for me. Because I've been in touch with a guy named Phil Butler, who was an Air Force pilot. He was the number 8 captive in North Vietnam. He served almost 2 years longer than John McCain in the Hanoi Hilton and other prisons in the North before being repatriated. And he described in vivid detail several situations where the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, would bring in foreign news reporters, so crews from France or Britain or Russia, and they would bring these POWs out, and they were sleep-deprived, and they'd been in darkness, and so, they can barely see, and still they were put on the spot by these news crews, and they were being prompted to try to say something bad about the United States.
Right.
And so it is a classic technique used against people in captivity. But the way it's spelled out in this memo really seemed almost silly in the kind of exercise that they were setting up.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, it does. And you know, keep in mind that this wasn't prepared. I mean, this manual, and people look at this manual, they need to know, first they need to know that this wasn't prepared for the purposes of torturing detainees. This was truly prepared for, you know, service members who went through this program, this survival training, these classes, these courses, that, you know, when they're on special missions, if they're captured, this is what could happen to them. So, you know, if you go back to December of 2001, there were calls that were being made to, you know, the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency, you know, that sort of oversaw this whole SEER program, and amongst other things. And, you know, they wanted to know about techniques, about these physical and psychological pressures. So paperwork was sent, and, you know, we saw various other pieces of, or various other documents released over the years about what U.S. service members were subjected to. But that was, you know, there's a legitimate reason to, you know, to do that. Here you had a couple of guys, okay, who have absolutely no experience in sort of this real-world interrogation environment, as Steve Kleinman said, who basically hijacked it and, you know, took bits and pieces and created a, you know, their own little torture regime and that, you know, that the Bush administration used for many, many years.
And I want to invite listeners to come to peterbcollins.com or go to truthout.org, and I will link to your article. And in the opening paragraphs of the article is a link to the pre-academic laboratory operating instructions. That link will take you to the Pentagon's FOIA page, and you have to look for this innocuous title again, pre-academic laboratory operating instructions. When you do, you will download an approximately 37-page PDF. And, Jason, a couple of observations. As I read through this, it was stunning because it repeatedly refers to students, student, student, student. And
right.
that refers to the positive use of this manual in training programs, and the students are American soldiers. But if you were to go in and do a search and replace and remove student and put in, say, detainee, it then becomes a step-by-step manual. And I want to take a moment here. I just pulled this somewhat at random, but it strikes me because it was just the other day that the U.S. Supreme Court said that strip searches can occur for any person who is detained and taken into a local jail. And there doesn't have to be suspicion of contraband or furtive behavior. You could be pulled over for a taillight violation, and if they take you to jail for it, they have the right under this new Supreme Court ruling to strip search you.
Right.
So, in Section 9.3, it reads, strip searches and body cavity checks are sensitive areas that require strict guidelines be followed to avoid impropriety or the perception of impropriety. Tell that to Justice Scalia.
Right.
Or
yeah.
Maybe Justice Kennedy, the swing vote on this decision. It goes on. Searches and body cavity checks are conducted silently. A PRA-approved observer must be present. I mean, there are all these rules and regulations to conduct this, and some of it almost becomes ridiculous, the level of detail that they go into. But we know that Condoleezza Rice, during the first Bush term, when she served as National Security Advisor, was, in fact, micromanaging individual torture sessions from the White House to the black sites or to Afghanistan, saying, yeah, you can waterboard him again, or, yeah, you can leave him in a stress position. I mean, that's what they were doing. And
right.
it's breathtaking now to see the manual that they may have been, in fact, referring to in real time as they say, oh, yeah, let's dunk Zubeda another time and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, it certainly confirms to me, Peter, that there is a lot more information that still needs to come out. And I will tell you that I know that many people who I've spoken to, at least, are sort of on the fence about this, and some even admittedly say, look, they, you know, it's a conspiracy theory. But I am starting to believe more and more, based on the evidence, based on my conversations with sources and various other individuals involved in or knowledgeable about the whole torture program, particularly just on Zubeda, that much of his torture, if not all of it, took place before the issuance of that memo.
Yeah.
And his attorney believes that. His attorney, you know, he said it on the record. He said, look, I have said for the longest time, and I believe that my client, you know, his torture was actually over before the memo was written. And the memo was more or less just the cover for what they were already doing. And now we know, you start looking at May of 2002, you start reading Ali Soufan's book, or just, frankly, the thing you have to, but, you know, take a look at it, see what he has to say, see the various techniques that were happening. You start to realize that he was being subjected to a lot. And I want to make an important point to follow up what you said, because many people are also sort of dismissive about the whole idea of experiment. In Ali Soufan's book, when he is, and certainly giving him quite the plug today, but he talks about his presence at the black site, and he goes into pretty great, good detail about what was happening in May of 2002. He calls all of the techniques, he refers to all of the techniques that Zubeda was subjected to that month, the ones that were being introduced as experiments, over and over and over again. It's not just one reference. It was many, many, many references, particularly sleep deprivation. There is, you know, description about depriving Zubeda of sleep for 24 hours. Oh, that didn't work. We didn't break him. Okay, let's go for 48. All right, let's go for 72. They eventually ended up in the torture memo saying that you can keep him up for 11 days. Now, based on what we know, what we've seen, what we've read, or at least what I've read and seen, it's starting to look like, well, how did they arrive at that number? Perhaps they, you know, they found a number that, you know, that he could stay awake in which he wouldn't go mad. Now, I actually reported that a couple of years ago based on information I obtained from intelligence sources. But it certainly has a whole other, makes a different impact now. Now it makes quite the impact based on, you know, what has surfaced then. Mm-hmm.
And now I'm looking at the part of the manual that relates to extreme temperature exposure. And once again, this is bizarre in many respects, because it's a blueprint for how to torture somebody without quite killing them. And it goes into great detail about there's a wind chill table here so that you can calculate just how cold the person is experiencing, not just what the temperature shows up on a gauge. And, you know, it says, provide adequate ventilation when students are placed in confined facilities. Students will not be placed in cramped confinement in direct sunlight without ventilation. And so, you know, they're saying avoid prolonged exposure to direct sunlight. So they're worried about, the potential for skin cancer from overexposure to ultraviolet rays, as they are laying out the plan,
right,
of exactly how to torture people. And this you know, the guidelines that they offer are bizarre in that respect. But I guess that's how the military writes a manual.
Right, yeah. Well, it is strange. But, again, it's not new in the sense that these sort of descriptions have been, you know, around for a very long time. It's, you know, again, I want to emphasize that when you look at the, and I held this up, Peter, and it really did make a different impact on me. You know, I read that torture memo again just a couple of days ago after going through this document, and it left a different impact in that it certainly, you come away with a feeling that they knew, they must have known that this was about getting false confession. They must have known that. They must have been aware that what they were doing was not going to get reliable information. And, you know, there's still so much that, you know, that we don't know. So many more questions that still need to be answered. But it's frightening. It's frightening to, you know, to look at that again and to see what our government was, you know, what it was creating. I'll note that a couple of days ago, the State Department put out another press release. I believe I've mentioned this to you before. They do this routinely, and there's no question that what has taken place in Syria has been horrific in terms of the systematic murder of civilians there. But it strikes me as just so, again, hypocritical when you see the State Department put out a press release, you know, promoting and demanding a sort of what they call a coalition of accountability to hold people accountable,
yeah,
you know, in Syria for these horrific human rights abuses and crime. And you know, it's not something where you can say, well, you know, what we did wasn't that bad. It's bad. You know, there should not be any sort of like measuring stick.
Well, we have, particularly since Obama has refused to investigate or prosecute what appear to be clear crimes here, we have no moral high ground to occupy when it comes to these issues. And when we lecture Bashar al-Assad, now, it's fair to say the United States has never taken tanks into civilian, suburban neighborhoods and blasted away at buildings. But we've been covering this on my podcast and in Sibel Edmonds' Boiling Frogs podcast with correspondents from around the world. And all I can say is that the picture in Syria is much more complicated than we're being told. There are American boots on the ground in Syria, in Jordan, in Turkey, on the two borders with Syria. We don't know exactly what their role is, and we don't know who some of these snipers are, who are alleged to be either Bashar al-Assad supporters or defectors. But as I say, there is much more in terms of layers of complexity in Syria. But I take your central point,
yeah,
that we have no credibility
when
we lecture other governments about abuse of their citizens.
Yes, that's what we do. And guess what? We do it very well. We're great at it.
And Jason, I wanted to take a little detour here just to note that on April Fool's Day, Curveball went public. And Curveball,
yeah,
is the chemical engineer Rafid Ahmed Alwan al-Janabi, who spun the lies about the mobile weapons lab that led Lawrence Wilkerson to help create graphics that were used in Colin Powell's February 6th speech to the United Nations, claiming that Saddam Hussein had these mobile weapon labs and was prepared to use them. And this is just another way that these cover-ups are unraveling. And I'd like to ask your thoughts on really, you know, what could be disclosed or exposed next, because I think that we're getting somewhere. We're starting to see important revelations.
Right.
The problem, of course, we have is that we have a government that is willfully turning a blind eye to them and refuses to either, you know, investigate or prosecute wrongdoing.
They will never get to that point where they will investigate, particularly, Peter, when, you know, Jeff has actually spent quite a bit of time working on this. When you look real deep into, you know, this administration and the individuals there, you'll find that many of them, you know, were also working during the Bush administration and were very involved with issues surrounding torture, detainee interrogation issues. I think that, you know, it's been 10 years. You know, keep in mind that this document, for example, that was 10 years ago. You know, so a decade has passed. We're starting to see more information surface, and I think we'll continue to see that. I think that passage of time has basically led to, you know, people are just no longer interested. They don't care. It doesn't have any more real value to them. And, you know, let's use this story as an example. You know, it's John Yoo, who was responsible for, obviously, and Jay Bybee for drafting this memo. But, you know, it goes to a community that is very interested in this. But that's where it ends. There's no one in the public demanding any accountability. They really are not. There's absolutely no one demanding that individuals be held accountable for abuses, for any of these crimes. So, but I do think at the same time, it's so important that we have an accurate record, accounting of what took place and how this evolved, how we were truly led to, you know, as Dick Cheney calls it, the dark side. I think that's crucial. So the worst thing that could happen is that we just simply don't write about it anymore or talk about it. That's the worst thing that would happen. But
well, and Jason, this leads me back to my conversation with Elizabeth Holtzman, who, you know, comes by her position credibly. She was on the Watergate committee that impeached President Nixon.
Right.
And she went public calling for the impeachment of Bush and Cheney in 05 or 06.
Right.
But as a Democrat, she seems to be quite reluctant to really be honest about what has happened since Obama took over.
Right.
And in her book, she cites the Jeppesen case, where Obama asserted state secrets privilege over public information.
Right.
And she goes on at length about the need to reform the state secret privilege. And I certainly agree. That's a tool that has been used to avoid embarrassing disclosures, not to, in general, protect any significant sensitive information.
That's correct. The state secrets privilege, by the way, particularly in that case, and I'm not sure, forgive me, Peter, I haven't, you know, listened to the podcast yet, but that particular case, you know, what after Obama was sworn into office in January of 2009, this case came up for a hearing in February, if I'm
right.
not mistaken.
You are correct.
And this was asserted right then and there.
At the Ninth Circuit here in San Francisco, and the panel of judges looked at the federal prosecutor and said, have you checked with Washington on this?
Right, exactly.
You're arguing the same damn position you did for Bush.
Yeah, they were actually surprised, and I'm glad you mentioned that. The judges were, are you sure you don't want to go back? You know, and so this state secrets, it's state secrets abuses is what, you know, is what has been taking place right immediately after, you know, Obama was sworn into office. His Justice Department started asserting state secrets. So I really don't think that, I think that this document is important. I don't think that it's going to change anything in terms of accountability. I don't think that there will ever be accountability. Juan Mendez, who is the UN Special Rapporteur for Torture, who I've interviewed recently, you know, he has a different thought. He thinks that even if it's in 10 years, there will be accountability. Now, he himself was a victim of torture during Argentina's Dirty War, and now he's starting to see decades later, 30, you know, some odd years later, you know, officials there held to account to answer for their crimes and being jailed. So he's a very patient man, and he is the one who, you know, referred to what Obama is doing, and I had written about this, as a twisted version of American exceptionalism.
Right.
So, but again, I think there will be more revelations that surface. And look, you know, just hours after this story broke, this story that Jeff and I put together, a new document surfaced under the Freedom of Information Act that was obtained by the National Security Archive out of Georgetown, or George Washington University.
And Jason, I was just about to raise that, so thank you. Excellent segue there.
Yeah, it's
this is because I wanted to get your thoughts. This was written by Phil Zelikow, and it was let's just recap. Zelikow was a top advisor, a former co-author with Condoleezza Rice on the National Security Council.
Right.
Then he left the White House to manage the cover-up at the 9/11 Commission, and from the White House point of view, he did a remarkable job there. And then when Rice was promoted for her failures to Secretary of State in the second Bush term,
right,
Zelikow returned to her side as an assistant at the State Department.
Yeah.
And in, 2005, 2006, he wrote a memo, which appears to be a very clear cover-your-ass memo, about an opposing view of the legality of the torture techniques. And I wanted to get your thoughts because, you know, my cursory reading of this is that this is well after the fact. It's 4 years after the initial torture policies had been set in motion. And all of a sudden, he writes a memo. The administration is so embarrassed that they track down, they think, every copy and destroy it.
Right.
But as Zelikow speculated in testimony before Congress in 2009, he said, well, there might be a copy or two in the State Department archives, and the FOIA request revealed that that was in fact true.
Yeah, he wrote this memo, just FYI, Peter, in regard to the second torture memo that replaced the first torture memo.
Correct.
This was the Bradbury memo. So that was in, I believe it was late 2005. I think October of 2005, if I'm not mistaken, is when Steve Bradbury wrote a new memo to replace this other one. And so, you know, Zelikow had basically put together some a six-page memo that more or less said, hey, you know, the fact is that we can't, you know, this violates the Eighth Amendment. He's still sort of covering up. It's not as explosive, to be honest with you, as he had us believe in regard to, you know, what he said about everything being destroyed. I certainly can understand why they wouldn't want this out there, because he's, you know, he's speaking specifically about some of the more, you know, coercive techniques, and he actually says that, by the way, which happen to be four or five of them that are directly from this manual. You know, cramped confinement, walling, being them, those techniques. So I think it's important. It's very important. But, you know, to quote a close colleague who has written about this extensively, Marcy Wheeler, you know, she says that while it shows that he was fighting in part against, you know, the negligence of his boss, Condoleezza Rice, at the same time he continued to cover for his boss, Condoleezza Rice. So it's important. It's on the record. But if it's, you know, he was still engaged in that sort of, we need to protect, you know, the top official.
Well, and Jason, this is with full 2020 hindsight, but as I look at the Zelikow memos here, I see him playing the same role trying to scrub the awful record of his boss, Condoleezza Rice, as Larry Wilkerson has tried to do for Colin Powell.
Right.
And I give Wilkerson credit. I give Powell some credit.
I will actually give Wilkerson a lot of credit. And the reason I will give him a lot of credit, Peter, and I actually have this conversation with again, with Jeff, we were, you know, talking about various individuals involved here. I think he recognized, you know, what took place. He went on the record stating that he would testify in a court of law to state that Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and others knew they were holding, you know, innocent detainees at Guantanamo, and he signed a sworn affidavit in the, you know, in the case of another detainee. Who was held indefinitely at Guantanamo, was cleared for release, and then was held for, you know, for many more years, that he would testify under oath if need be, and make those statements and disclose what he knew and when he knew it. So I will give him credit for that, because I have yet to see anyone actually say, I will go into a court of law,
mm-hmm.
or anyone sign an affidavit saying, I will do this. So, but at the same time, to get to your larger point about Colin Powell, yes, I think that there's, and I've written about it, I think that there's quite a bit that he still needs to, you know, answer for.
Well, and just as Condoleezza Rice did not return your calls to Stanford's Hoover Institution,
right?
Colin Powell generally allows his proxy, Wilkerson, to try to scrub the record. And I would invite both Powell and Rice to come clean. And
yeah.
I would even grant them immunity were it in my power. Because
Look, I never expected, you know, Condoleezza Rice to, you know, to get back to me. And say whether she saw it or not. You know, it's important to note in the context of this whole story. You know, I wrote this document is presented in the context that one, it was May of 2002, and two, it was presented to top Bush officials during that month, and they debated it. They discussed exactly what techniques. There was verbal authorization, and Condoleezza Rice told the Senate Armed Services Committee in response to a series of questions, the Armed Services Committee investigated the treatment of detainees in custody of the U.S. And, government, that she never saw a list of SEER training techniques. Her legal advisor, John Bellinger, said he did not recall seeing a list of any SEER training techniques. And I think it's pretty clear that they did see a list of SEER training techniques, and I believe that, you know, if the Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin, you know, the senator who helped draft the National Defense Authorization Act, were to take a deeper look at this, or a closer look rather, he perhaps would find that. And I think in his statement he more or less alluded to you know, the fact that Condoleezza Rice wasn't being truthful. But this—it's hard to believe that they did not, you know, take a look at this.
Yeah. The other thing is, I just like to extend the timeline there a little bit to reflect Guantanamo, because it wasn't until August of 2002 that memos went back and forth between Rumsfeld at the Pentagon,
right,
and the leadership at Guantanamo, and basically, Rumsfeld got the folks at Guantanamo to ask his permission to use these techniques. And yet what's not on the record, at least that I have seen so far, is any communication, say, between the State Department and John Yoo sharing his memo with the folks at Guantanamo to close that loop. Because it's clear that Rumsfeld knew what he was asking for.
Right.
But he was reluctant to initiate the process of torturing inmates at Guantanamo. He wanted it to come as a request from the leadership in place at the prison. And
that's how it ultimately worked out.
And then his memo authorizing those techniques, I believe, was December of 2002.
That's correct. And I believe that may be the memo, which he says, I stand for 8 hours a day.
It is.
So yes, that's you know, that's when it happened, and you know, Alberto Mora, could be mistaken, but one of the officials started taking a look at you know, some of the things that he had authorized techniques, and mm-hmm. Again, John Yoo jumps in and, you know, puts together a legal memoranda.
Yeah. Well, Jason, this is great work. I want you to keep at it. And just keep filing those FOIA requests.
You're really... Hey, Peter, do you mind if I actually talk about that very briefly?
Go right ahead.
I want to make it clear that I did not obtain this through a FOIA request that I filed. The backstory on this, Peter, is that I do file many FOIA requests, and I'm also taking a look at government websites where they have reading rooms where you can read recently posted documents. It's a very, you know, it's very boring to some people. I happen to think it's a lot of fun. You never know what they're going to post.
Well, I almost dozed off before I found the listing for the pre-all memo on the the DOD website.
Well, exactly. So it's on the DOD website. And, you know, I crack open every document there. You never know what's going to be there, Peter. And sometimes I have to be honest with you, I don't think the government knows what they're putting out. I'm actually shocked that they released this because they, you know, continue to talk about sources and methods and what we don't want to subject or don't want to reveal to the enemy. So it turns out that someone else filed a FOIA request for this, and that someone else is a news organization, McClatchy.
Oh,
McClatchy
okay.
News. This was turned over to them several months ago. They never wrote about it. They never discussed it. They never wrote about it. They certainly didn't, you know, I don't think understood the significance of it. It could be wrong, but that's just my personal opinion. So when, you know, when I saw this and when Jeff saw it, it's funny, we actually crossed emails, Jeff and I. We both zeroed in on the, you know, on the same document, and we crossed emails and said, "Did you see this?" And so, you know, we put together. That's when we put together this story. So, in the land of FOIA, it's our scoop now.
Well, in your spare time, you might seek a quote from McClatchy's D.C. bureau.
Yeah.
And thank them for getting this released, and ask them why they haven't written about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've done better work than most inside the Beltway corporate journalists.
And look, you know, had it not been for the fact that we also, Jeff and I wrote that, Jeff certainly, you know, was on this, has been on this issue, particularly as it relates to SEER for many, many years. But look, you know, a year ago we published the first, you know, insight into the mind of the architect of the torture program. So we had his handwritten notes, which... there are a number of similarities. So this immediately we felt that this is going to make a great, you know, companion piece to that story. If you just happen to be someone to download it, you probably wouldn't realize that it was cited in the Office of Professional Responsibility report. It doesn't say that. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know that this was something that, you know, was used by John Yoo to draft the torture memo.
Great work, Jason. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Jason Leopold, investigative reporter and deputy managing editor, truthout.org. It may take a while, but the truth shall set us free. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.